About the time the baby boomers were born, breastfeeding was coming back into vogue. And when it came all the way back. Everybody who knows anything about babies and child development seems to recommend breastfeeding these days for the myriad of benefits it confers. And our guest today does not disagree with the conferring of benefits. She breastfed her own kids, but Courtney Young takes issue with the tone, at least, of the movement, the sense of you must breastfeed your children. She spends 200 pages outlining the issues in the book Lactivism, how feminists and fundamentalists, hippies and yuppies, and physicians and politicians made breastfeeding big business and bad policy. Courtney Young is a political science professor at the University of Toronto. She clearly does not shy from hot-button issues, judging by the titles of her previous two books, Then I Was Black, and The Moral Force of Indigenous Politics. Courtney Young, glad to have you on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much.
Subtitle first, is breastfeeding itself bad policy, or do you mean the policies to encourage breastfeeding?
The policies to encourage breastfeeding, absolutely.
And what are your major...
policies that we've implemented in the United States in particular to encourage breastfeeding.
Well, for one thing, the breast pump comes up again and again. So first, some numbers on what do you know about how many women, what percentage breastfeed their children, how many, what percentage women pump, that sort of thing?
Well, breastfeeding numbers, the most recent numbers we have are from children born in 2011, and those numbers were 79% of American women initiating breastfeeding and 49% still breastfeeding at 6 months. As far as pumping goes, the only research that was done on that was in 2007, and that showed that 85% of American women who breastfed also used a pump. But in 2013, the Affordable Care Act was amended to require insurance companies to cover the cost of breast pumps for new mothers. So since 2007, you know, that number, we can assume that that number is practically up close to 100% at this point, since all new mothers in the United States are being provided with free breast pumps.
Free breast pump. And you start off with the story of a store in New York City about, is it New York City or is it Toronto, actually? Yummy.
No, it's New York City, okay. On the Upper East Side of New York.
All right. Yummy Mummy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can tell about the people I don't hang with. Yummy Mummy is the store name, but it means more than just the name of that store. Give us an idea of the Yummy Mummy milieu.
The Yummy Mummy profile?
Yeah.
The Yummy Mummy, you know, I think it's an English term, and it's a mother who is young and hip and gorgeous and hasn't lost her sense of style, even though she's out there in, you know, even though she's had a baby. So the idea is that you can be a mother and still be glamorous and fabulous.
And how is this represented in the store called Yummy Mummy, which apparently has breast pumps and a lot more?
Yeah, well, it has, the idea is, you know, I think it's part of a move to normalize breastfeeding and to give women, it used to be the case in the 70s, even in the 80s, I think, that breastfeeding was associated with sort of a lefty, crunchy, granola kind of lifestyle. And so the idea is to get it into the mainstream and to convince women that they can, you know, that they can still leave the house and look great even if they're breastfeeding. So in the store, yes, I think they make most of their money in pumps, but they also sell clothes that come from companies with names like Glamour Mom and Boob, actually, is another company that makes breastfeeding clothes. And, of course, bras and nutritional supplements that you can take to increase your milk supply, lactation cookies. One of the points I make in the book is it's a pretty expensive little niche market. Breastfeeding clothes are, you know, they're almost all made of cotton. There's nothing particularly special about them, but they're incredibly expensive. And lactation cookies will run you $20. A packet, fenugreek, all kinds of, you know, nutritional supplements. It's quite expensive.
And a lot of marketing to go with it, too, as you point out. I mean, because the puns go on and on. You cite some other store names like Upper Breast Side and stuff like that in New York City.
Yeah, so. There's the Pump Station in Santa Monica.
All right. So just a lot of stylishness and hipness that seems to go with breastfeeding. Let's go to the title of the book, though. Give us the difference between advocacy for breastfeeding and lactivism, the term you're coining here.
Right. So, in fact, I need to say up front, I didn't coin that term.
Ah.
Lactivism was coined by breastfeeding advocates themselves, and it's a conflation of lactation and activism, people who are, you know, activists around breastfeeding. So they came up with this name themselves. But the distinction that I make in the book is that, breastfeeding advocacy, I would say, would be people and policies that support a woman who herself chooses to breastfeed. Breastfeeding isn't easy. Women, it's not something that's actually, people are not born knowing how to do it. People need to be taught how to breastfeed. And we don't have enough support for people who want to breastfeed in the United States, in particular because we don't have maternity leave, federally mandated paid maternity leave. So breastfeeding advocacy would be about providing support for women who want to breastfeed. Lactivism crosses the line from that kind of support to really taking the strong position that, A, all women can breastfeed, and that all women should breastfeed. That breastfeeding is a key component of good parenting, that it's an obligation that a mother assumes when she gets pregnant or has a baby. All of these things would cross the line from breastfeeding advocacy into lactivism.
Lactivism is the name of Courtney Young's book. We'll come back and talk much more about the contents of that book and take your questions and comments by phone and by email. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Courtney Young and you in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the University of Toronto political scientist Courtney Young. She's written a book called Lactivism, How Feminists and Fundamentalists, Hippies and Yuppies, and Physicians and Politicians Made Breastfeeding Big Business and Bad Policy. Talking about instead of support, it's more like coercion. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your thoughts on the issue. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I must admit, there's a couple places in the book where your jaw is likely to drop, and one of them is to find that breastfeeding is required by law in some countries?
Actually, it is, yeah, in Saudi Arabia, and actually in a couple of other countries, though I don't remember which ones.
Not democratic countries, if Saudi Arabia is any guide.
No, it's not like voting in Australia.
Okay, but there are some people who advocate a law like that here.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I have never heard of anybody saying that breastfeeding should be the law in the United States. A couple of years ago, Gisele Bündchen said that there should be a worldwide law requiring women to breastfeed. But I believe she subsequently backed down on that.
Okay. Gisele Bündchen can be a bit of a lightning rod, given that she's got her own career and her own outspokenness, and she's married to Tom Brady, who also is a lightning rod for criticism as the Patriots quarterback. So let's come back to your own personal experience here. You had a daughter, and before she was born, you got cornered by a lactivist at a party, it sounds like.
I did. Yeah, that was probably my very first experience, and it was, I was 39 years old. I'd spent years and years not thinking about babies and pregnancy and children or anything like that. And suddenly, so the interest in breastfeeding and the fervor around breastfeeding really took me by surprise. So it started with the woman at the party who, she spent forever talking about the joys and benefits of breastfeeding. And
the description of her as gesticulating with her cosmopolitan until she finally backed you into a wall, though, is it sounds like there's quite a bit of urgency attached to the message.
Yeah, there was, and it just went on and on. I mean, it was probably, you know, most notable to me because, of course, I was stone cold sober, so I was, you know, I was really really alert to her cosmopolitan, and the way it might attack me.
That's a wonderful way to look at it. You know, I can imagine there are some people who were looking laser beams at the radio at this point. And so I want to come down to where you stand on the benefits of breastfeeding. I think you don't dispute certainly some of them, but there are some qualifications you attach here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's good evidence that breastfeeding is protective against infection during the period that the baby is actually breastfeeding. Now, qualified that by saying those benefits are actually fairly modest. The director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, Dr. David Mayers, explained that 6 women would have to breastfeed exclusively for 6 months to prevent 1 ear infection. And so, you know, I think that a lot of people might make the calculation that that's worth it, that preventing that ear infection is an important benefit that they would, that they're willing to breastfeed for. Other women would make a different calculation. There's also very good evidence that breastfeeding has no impact on obesity, type 1 diabetes, asthma, allergies, and most cancers. And then with respect to everything else, all of the other long-term benefits that have been, that are sometimes associated with breastfeeding, the research is either weak or inconclusive, meaning, you know, there are studies that show that it does and studies that show that it doesn't, and at this point we really don't know.
But it seems like everybody and his brother's doctor have been saying for years that breastfeeding is wonderful. It's a, you know, a cure-all. It's going to, you know, protect your kid from so many things. It increases bonding with the mother, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's what I'm sort of focused on here is what explains, how can we understand this vast disconnect between what medical research actually shows and what we believe, right? Why do we have such a misperception about how breastfeeding can protect our children against pretty much everything?
Courtney Young's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Lactivism, about moving from support to coercion for breastfeeding. Is there a universal zone of age everyone seems to agree on, birth to 6 months, for example?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So the WHO recommendation, which is also the American Academy of Pediatrics, the CDC, the U.S. Surgeon General, is exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months.
Okay. You mentioned, I think the figures you mentioned about the women who are still breastfeeding at 6 months, 49%. So it's a bit of a drop-off. Is this just because women go back to work? Is that a lot of it?
Well, that is a lot of it. The number working is the number one reason that women give, or it's the number one differentiator, the number one variable that distinguishes, that determines how long women will breastfeed and whether or not they will even initiate breastfeeding. So women who are planning to return to work are much less likely to initiate breastfeeding and much more likely to give up early. So in general, stay-at-home mothers are much more able to comply, but in fact, much more likely to comply with the 6 months of exclusive breastfeeding recommendation in the United States.
Courtney, the term you use for the people who, well, lactivists, I guess, one of the other terms you apply is a moral righteousness surrounding breastfeeding. How does that manifest?
Basically, in people moving from a position that is, I breastfeed my babies, I think that's a good personal choice for me, to everyone should breastfeed their babies. And so that's, you know, women experience that in the hospital when their babies are born, in baby-friendly hospitals where they are not allowed to be given formula shift from other parents in particular. Mothers and fathers feel very comfortable telling women who are bottle feeding that, you know, they really ought to be breastfeeding. Women have heard all kinds of horrible things. Women who are, you know, bottle feeding their babies. They might even be bottle feeding their babies breast milk. But of course, who would know? So sometimes even women who are, you know, bottle feeding breast milk come under this kind of pressure.
In fact, you have a story of a woman riding the subway in New York, I think, who actually was bottle feeding her child breast milk. And sitting under all the signs on the subway about the Latch On NYC campaign.
Yeah. That campaign was, you know, breast milk is best for your baby, which is one of the other parts of my story is really how we've moved from thinking about breastfeeding to thinking about breast milk. You know, the advent of pumping in the United States has really changed the focus so that now we don't think of the benefit of breastfeeding as being, you know, mother-infant bonding at the breast anymore. We're thinking of it as the chemical properties of human milk. So human milk has become a product that, you know, is routinely bought and sold on the open market. And it's the milk that matters rather than the way in which the milk is delivered. And that's a really big change in how we perceive and understand what counts as breastfeeding. And so there are a few things that are problematic about that. The first is that there's been no research done at all on the differences in health outcomes between babies who are fed breast milk from a bottle and babies who are breastfed.
So we don't know the health effects for the milk without the mother attached.
No. We have no idea if they are in fact the same thing. No research has been done on that. And yet U.S. policies are proceeding blithely as if they are exactly the same thing. You know, all of our breastfeeding public initiatives of the last 5 years or so are all geared towards the benefits of breast milk and towards promoting pumping. So they're all providing support for and basically support for women to pump at work and also the free breast pumps. None of them are in fact promoting breastfeeding at all. They're promoting pumping because, of course, that is seen as an alternative to maternity leave. And it's explicitly understood by public health authorities as we can't really promote breastfeeding because the workplace isn't cut out for it, and we're not thinking of transforming the workplace, and we're not thinking of introducing maternity leave, so instead we need to promote pumping. And pumping, of course, we don't know what the benefits are for the baby on the one hand, and secondly, of course, it creates a much different and bigger burden on the mother. You know, pumping is just not the same as breastfeeding when it comes to a mother's experience of it, and it's hard.
You describe it as it's like a fairly robotic process.
Yeah.
That nobody can love.
Yeah. No, and especially, you know, these work breaks that are provided that are mandatory now. They're unpaid work breaks. And some, you know, big companies with good human resources departments have lactation rooms. But a lot of women, arguably most women in the United States, are pumping at work in, you know, unused broom closets and supply closets or in, you know, in empty rooms in big factories and under really unpleasant conditions. And those work breaks are unpaid. So they're either making less money or they, you know, the Department of Health and Human Services encourages employers to ask women to come in early or stay late to make up for those unpaid work breaks. So they're either making less money or they're being asked to work longer hours in order to. So, you know, the burden is all on the mother.
Courtney Young is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Lactivism, How Feminists and Fundamentalists, Hippies and Yuppies, and Physicians and Politicians Made Breastfeeding Big Business and Bad Policy. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about support versus coercion with breastfeeding. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's some good history in here as well, and you go way back in time. You found out a fair amount, it looks like, about the frequency of lactation failure through time. It's not unusual.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a really important point to bring up, is one of the things that breastfeeding advocates insist is that all women can breastfeed. And so if it's really true that all women can breastfeed, then of course it's a personal failure. If you can't breastfeed, something's gone wrong with you. Whereas, in fact, lactation failure, what they call lactation failure, is really common, and it's always existed. So wet nursing is, you know, probably the oldest profession is not actually prostitution, it's wet nursing. And there's evidence, you know, thousands and thousands of years old of baby bottles being found, et cetera. And so it's true today that not all women can breastfeed, but it's always been true. One of the things that's very frustrating is, you know, that people insist that breastfeeding has to be universally possible because otherwise human beings would have died out thousands of years ago.
The pressure sounds great. You describe a woman sobbing in a pediatrician's office because it just wasn't happening for her. And it sounds like people end up feeling like they're less than a whole woman if they can't breastfeed.
Well, they do. You know, since in the last few months, I've received literally hundreds of emails from women telling me their own personal stories about what it felt like for them when they weren't able to breastfeed, and how awful it was. And these stories are so poignant, especially because, you know, all of this is happening in the very first few weeks and months after your baby is born, which is a time that can be precious and wonderful in a woman's life. And these women are experiencing it as horrible, because they feel so inadequate and so ashamed and so awful and so profoundly sorrowful. And it's partly because they're told, you know, you're doing something wrong. You're not trying hard enough. And, you know, all they want to do in the world is breastfeed. They're trying everything they can, and they simply can't. And if those mechanisms were better, not even understood. I mean, they're perfectly well understood. Doctors know that, insufficient glandular tissue is a real thing that prevents mothers from producing enough milk to feed their babies, that women who have thyroid conditions often don't produce enough milk to feed their babies. Any kind of condition that produces hormonal imbalances is going to affect milk production. Difficulties during childbirth can affect milk production. The list of things that can affect milk production is actually quite long, and everybody knows about it, but it's really, really underdiagnosed because we're living in this world where so many people believe that every woman can breastfeed.
And it was not always so. I mean, it was not always urged that way anyway. And as you point out, it began to split along class lines in the 19th century, where upper-class women did not breastfeed their children. And it stayed out of vogue, it looks like, for several decades. How low did the numbers get, do we know?
Yeah, the low point of breastfeeding in the United States was, I think it was a 24% initiation rate in 1971. And
wow.
So between 1971 and 2011, what's that, 40 years, we climb from 24% to 79%.
That's a zoom. That counts as, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We've really gone, you know, in the other direction. And part of the zeal of lactation advocacy comes from the history. You know, it comes from the fact that in 1956, when La Leche League was started, the number of mothers breastfeeding was a very small minority. And there was no support for breastfeeding. There was nowhere that women could learn how to breastfeed. And the medical establishment, doctors, pediatricians, were all strongly recommending formula feeding. And so women who wanted to breastfeed were really in the minority, and they really felt, you know, they were really made to feel like outliers, mm-hmm. or, you know, excluded and marginalized. And then in the 1970s, you have the Nestle boycott. And so at that point, you know, you've got Nestle marketing aggressively in poor countries, which leads to marketing its formula in poor countries, which leads to a spike in infant malnutrition and mortality. And so people are protesting against Nestle, and the solution to, you know, Nestle to the use of formula is to reestablish breastfeeding as the norm. And so in the 70s, breastfeeding becomes a symbol of a struggle against big business and corporate greed. So it in both of these periods, in the 50s and the 70s, there's a sense that breastfeeding is all about, is a sort of an embattled minority struggling against entrenched professional and corporate interests, and that we're on the side of goodness and light, and we're fighting for a woman's right to breastfeed.
Well, and I'm a minority no more, as is well pointed out. The book is Lactivism. Courtney Young, the author, political science professor at the University of Toronto. We'll come back and talk more with Courtney, and you can join us on The Exchange back here in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is University of Toronto political scientist Courtney Young. Her book is Lactivism: How Feminists and Fundamentalists, Hippies and Yuppies, and Physicians and Politicians Made Breastfeeding Big Business and Bad Policy. We've just been talking about the major shift from nearly no breastfeeding by 1971 to a huge turnaround in the numbers since that time. A lot of support, but a fair amount of coercion as well, as perceived by Courtney Young. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange, particularly women, if you've been through this whole process and either have chosen to breastfeed or have chosen not to, and the things that you felt supported or worked against you in your decision. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about Nestle and that big uproar in the 60s and 70s about Nestle hawking infant formula so strongly in poverty-ridden countries. I remember the stink about that, but I had not heard about the Nestle nurses before. What was the story there?
Well, one of the ways that Nestle was marketing in poor countries was by dressing their employees up as nurses and sending them into hospitals and clinics and into the homes of new mothers to sell formula. And of course, the reason to dress them up as nurses is to, generate the impression that formula was being medically recommended.
Oh, we talked about the rise of La Leche League. Let's talk about the origins of it, where it came from.
So La Leche League started in 1956. It was two Catholic mothers, Mary White and Marianne Thompson. They were sitting on the grass at a Christian Family Movement picnic, nursing their babies, and lamenting the fact that so few women were breastfeeding in those days and that there was no support for women breastfeeding. And so they got together with five more friends and started La Leche League as a mother-to-mother support network. So it's local chapters in towns of people who meet monthly, and basically just do that, provide mother-to-mother support. The idea was that the idea was to exclude doctors from, or to get away from a model where it was doctors who were primarily in charge of child care and child feeding. So to bring back a sense of community and a different way of thinking about, you know, who's responsible for parenting. And they spread very quickly. It went from one small group in 1956 to, I can't remember the numbers, but very quickly, On the other hand, they presided for the first, 15 years of their existence over a steady decline in breastfeeding numbers, until, as I said, the nadir of breastfeeding, which was 1971. But then the Nestle boycott really, that was a really important moment in the contemporary history of breastfeeding advocacy. It made breastfeeding much more widely known, the importance of breastfeeding. So it was in the 70s that you start to see medical research into breastfeeding.
And about that time, too, we had the founding of the WIC program, the Women, Infants, Children program for supplemental nutrition for for infants and mothers. But it, now it's gotten to the point where it encourages breastfeeding, too. And talk about how.
Well, in 2009, WIC introduced what they call the Enhanced Food Package. And there are four, the point of the Enhanced Food Package is to encourage women on WIC to breastfeed. So there are four components of it. The first is that women who are breastfeeding are eligible for WIC for twice as long as women who are not breastfeeding. Women who are breastfeeding get better food and more food than women who are not breastfeeding. The babies who are breastfeeding, once they start eating at 6 months, they will get more and better food than babies who are not breastfeeding. And WIC is not an entitlement program. So in the event that WIC funds are running out, WIC actually uses breastfeeding as a way of prioritizing registration. So WIC counselors are told to prioritize the registration of breastfeeding mothers over non-breastfeeding mothers. So in the event of a shortfall, breastfeeding can actually be used as a way of excluding women from WIC altogether.
All right, let's take some calls here. We have Rebecca in Junction City on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Courtney Young, the author of Lactivism.
Hi. I was wondering, I started thinking, why is there such a big issue about women needing support for breastfeeding? And then I realized that when my kids were young, I didn't work. So there wasn't any problems at all. I didn't have to worry about getting up from my desk or breast pumps or anything like that. And so it was, for me, it was simple. You put the baby on the breast and when the baby wants it and you're done. So it was very different. I didn't have to worry about time off. And so it was much, much easier, and now I understand where these issues are coming from.
All right. Thanks for the thoughts, Rebecca. Appreciate that. And that's really what you're getting at, Courtney, that if we had a system where people could afford to stay home until their kids were three, we'd probably not be having this discussion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The politics of this, of breastfeeding, are not the same in countries that have long maternity leaves. If we had a maternity leave policy that allowed women to, say the United States government is going to recommend, as it does, that women breastfeed exclusively for 6 months. If that's going to be the recommendation, then we ought to have 6 months of maternity leave. In the absence of that, it's women themselves who are being expected to square the circle. And that puts women in a very, very difficult position where they either, try like crazy to square the circle, and in many cases they do. We have, given the absence of maternity leave, we have very, very high rates of breastfeeding. 49% at 6 months, I think, is very high given the absence of maternity leave. But it's women who are shouldering that burden. It's not the United States government, and it's not employers.
Let's take another call. We have Leah in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Courtney Young.
Thank you. Just a couple of different things. One of the reasons that everybody was so appalled by what Nestle did was they were promoting breast, not to use breast milk, but to use their formula in a lot of countries where the water was polluted. And that, to me, is just unconscionable. And I had my own experiences. I had two daughters. I breastfed both. I remember one with one of them, my mother, when she first saw me breastfeeding, burst into tears, and I said, "Why are you crying?" And she said, "I always wanted to breastfeed the five of you, but your father said that since I didn't drink milk, my milk wouldn't be any good." Whereas my mother-in-law, it's awful. And my mother-in-law, who was helping us with our second child for a while when I would go to work, I would pump, and nobody ever prepares you for how painful it is to pump your own milk. But I would pump, and then she would say, oh, well, I had to give her the formula because she wouldn't take the breast milk from me, so I poured it down the drain. I cannot tell you. And it was, to me, a product of, she was, you know, from the 20s and 30s. My mother, I was born in 49, so my mother was a product of the 50s. But I would, the only reason I stopped breastfeeding my second daughter earlier was because she got teeth. And she knew how to use them.
Wow. That's an amazing story. Thanks for that, Lee.
You bet.
So I'd heard about the water in the foreign countries before, about the fact that making the formula, the Nestle formula, required water that was often contaminated, and that's included in the book. But wow, that comment from Lee's father to mother about
that makes you want to cry. I mean, that's, you know, part of the story here is that this new. What's happening now is simply part of what's always happened, which is women are always being told what to do with their bodies and how to feed their babies. And we've just, you know, in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, it was you must formula feed. And so breastfeeding advocates were standing up for the rights of women to choose how to feed their babies. And now it's swung full circle. You know, it's kind of crept up on us. And now it's you must breastfeed. And this is just a personalized case of, you know, this father telling this mother, you can't breastfeed. Because, you know, for whatever reason, because you're not drinking enough milk or something like that.
It seems to me, Courtney, though, that there's still some overlap between the pressure to breastfeed because it's natural and good for the kids, and yet still some resistance to an ick factor in public or something, you know, you shouldn't be breastfeeding your child in the airport or something, you know, take that kid into a room.
Right, simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got both happening in the United States. Absolutely. You know, and this is one of the other ways in which we in the U.S., we make it harder for women to breastfeed. I think that sort of the public opprobrium that comes along with breastfeeding it is not dissimilar to the absence of maternity leave. All of these things make it... You know, women who are really going to comply with the injunction to breastfeed exclusively for 6 months are very often they decide to quit their jobs in order to comply with that injunction. And they also might decide to stay at home, right? Because it's very hard to go out and breastfeed in public. You know, some women enjoy challenging people about breastfeeding in public, and you know they're willing to stare down strangers who are giving them dirty looks, but a lot of women aren't. They don't want to deal with that, and they'd rather just, you know, deal with breastfeeding at home in private so they don't have to deal with strangers and whatever their issues are with breastfeeding. Both of these things are going to keep women in the private sphere. They're going to keep women at home and out of public space. So all of this is happening, you know, at the same time in the United States.
Let's take another call. We have Don in Roseburg on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
And I was just going to ask the speaker about the antibodies in women's milk. Do they have antibodies?
Well, you know, there's something, so as I said, when I was talking about the benefits of breastfeeding, breastfeeding is beneficial for infections. It reduces the risk of infection. And the mechanisms for that are well worked out. So there is something in breast milk which reduces the risk of infection. But people think about antibodies in different ways. Those antibodies exist, but the idea that there are long-term benefits, that those will fundamentally affect a baby's long-term risk of infection, that has not been shown. So the researchers who have done research on infection say that the baby only gets protection from infection during the time the mother is actually breastfeeding. So for those 3 months or those 4 months or whatever it is, that protection does not last after she stops breastfeeding.
Now, the way in which breast milk is in vogue right now leads to some interesting things that I hadn't heard about before. There's actually breast milk in the artisanal food market.
Oh, yeah. You sure you want me to talk about that on air?
Why, sure.
Some people get alarmed.
Is there like breast milk cheese or something?
There's breast milk cheese. There's breast milk ice cream. There's lactation lasagna. There are momsicles, popsicles made from breast milk. Basically, anything that you can make that you might put milk or cream into, you can use breast milk for instead. Breast milk is lower in fat, though, so you need to add cow's milk or goat's milk to it anyway. You can't actually make a cheese that's wholly from human milk. But, yeah, lots of people are, and you know that's a product of pumping. Right? So women are pumping breast milk, and because they're pumping breast milk, they have a buildup, a supply of breast milk in their fridges and freezers. And at some point, they realize they have no idea what to do with this breast milk. Their own precious babies are never going to consume it all. And so they sell it. So there are online markets in breast milk. They sell it to other moms. They sell it to athletes who want to buy it. But they also use it to cook with, because if it is in fact the superfood, why wouldn't you use it for everything?
Makes a certain amount of sense. We certainly have heard of breast milk banks as well, so that women can share breast milk with women who don't have as much.
Absolutely, all
kinds of stuff. It's really a comprehensive look at things. Lactivism, how feminists and fundamentalists, hippies and yuppies, and physicians and politicians made breastfeeding big business and bad policy. Courtney Young wrote it, and she's been our guest on The Exchange. Courtney, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Jeff.
All right, take care.